We all want what Billy wants, the opportunity to receive and express the kiss. And so begins the story of Eve McGargle's memoir as she writes about her son, Billy. Learning to Kiss is the name of her memoir. Hello, folks. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I am very pleased to introduce to you Eve McGargle, the author of Learning to Kiss. Eve is considered a pioneer in advocating that all individuals on the autism spectrum have the kinds of services that they need, including adults. Many times when we think about individuals with autism, we think about children and children only. Eve is a part of a hospital-wide Adults with Autism initiative, which focuses on the medical, administrative, and informational needs of adult patients on the autism spectrum, and this is in Boston. Eve, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you very much.
It sounds like you are very busy in your hometown.
Well, yes. I'm busy on the home front. I'm a director of a program called Voice Colors, which is for adults, that provides them with opportunities to learn, develop, and cultivate independent self-expression grounded in social relationships. So I'm working, it's a kind of a well art and wellness program, and I partner with Jewish Family Services and individuals who are young adults primarily participate.
You begin your memoir with a note to the reader that your son Billy, who's now 25, was diagnosed at the age of 2 with autism. And you say that the news was both sobering and baffling, that he began to change before your eyes. How did he change?
Well, in Billy's case, up to the age of 2, there were no apparent symptoms. He was gregarious. His gross motor skills were great. He was moving, grooving, doing all kinds of things with his brother. So we really had no clue, except for one, that about the age of 18 months, he had words, and there were, like 50 words, and they seemed to be increasing. But one day in the hallway of our house, Billy comes up to me, and he's all, he's a toddler, and he looks at me, and he pauses, and there's this sort of expression on his face as if he's searching for something. And in that moment, I realized that he was having difficulty retrieving a word. And then he said the word and rushed away. But in that moment, I thought, there's something here. And then I realized that as time went on, I went to my pediatrician and I said, I don't believe that Billy is putting words together in phrases, which is the next stage. And she said, well, keep a journal. And then I went back in January, a couple months later, and I said, he's not only not putting words together, he's losing words. And that's when, we got the developmental team and so forth going on. Remember, though, that this is early 90s. Billy was born in, actually, he's 27 now, 1989. There was not a lot of press awareness of autism. It was very primitive times in terms of the culture's understanding of what autism means. And so resources were fairly limited.
It's interesting that you were so acutely aware of the changes in your son's attempt to communicate. There are certainly, a fair number of parents who would notice what you described as a change, notice it and not notice it. What do you think it was that allowed you to be so sensitive and so aware of the particular change as you described Billy's search for a word and then spitting it out and running away?
Well, it's a good question. I think that we had this very strong relationship and a bond that was sort of based upon the visual, all the social body language, you know, from physical gestures, intonations. So there was always, I was always watching, observing Billy in that way, as I did my other son, Ben. But I think for me, formerly I was an educator and a secondary. Maybe perhaps that, you know, this idea that there's the developmental aspects and sort of that there should be some progress being made in certain areas. I wasn't worried about Billy, you know, initially. It was only after he started losing words that I began to realize that something was wrong.
The you describe, you know, you went through all the tests, and then you describe the day that you and your husband were told by a nurse who was not a member of the team that had performed the tests mm-hmm. on Billy about the diagnosis. Describe that for us, if you would.
Yeah, that's a piece in the book, Learning to Kiss. It was summertime, and my husband and I were going to receive the reports from the various evaluations from different specialists that had happened in the last month for Billy. And we were informed that it would be, as you said, a cardiac nurse who happens to deliver these reports. For some reason, that bothered me, that someone who had never laid eyes on Billy was going to present these reports and had never met us, never talked to us, never engaged with Billy, never had made an observation. But then when she proceeded to talk about Billy, she used the word pervasive developmental disability. And I latched on to that word pervasive. And I said, pervasive, you know, what do you mean pervasive? Because at that point, and I think it's partially historically bounded that they didn't use the word right away with toddlers, autism, because he was so young that they didn't want to put that diagnosis on him until further developmental milestones had occurred. But, I mean, pervasive, you might as well have said autism to me, because it was so daunting and frightening on some level. And I remember it. One point she kept saying about who he is, you know, he has this deficit and this deficit and so forth and so forth. And finally, I just kind of looked at her and I said, you don't know who Billy is. And I kind of got a little bit of fighting side in me came out. I said, you don't know my child. He's not the culmination of all of these, you know, checklists. He has a lineage. He has a family. He has people who love him. He comes from a certain social environment. And I can't accept this sort of stereotyping of who you say he's going to be or who he is. And so she basically looked at us and she said, well, good luck to you. It will be a lot of hard work. And Matt and I, you know, things were closing down because it was a hospital setting at the end of the day on a Friday. We went into the parking lot, and I think we were just in shock. And by the end of we decided to go to a movie that night just to kind of regroup, I think. And we met a colleague of Matt's, and Matt couldn't remember his name, even though he works with him every day. It was so profound, the impact this was having on us.
There's something about delivering a diagnosis, certainly one of that magnitude, by somebody who you've never met at the end of the day, at the end of the week. I don't know.
Well, it was, I guess it was convenient.
For somebody.
You know, for somebody. My expectation, though, was that it would be someone from the team. I never dreamed, frankly, that it would not be. So it was very, you know, we were receiving reports from PT, OT, neurologist, you know, lots of different reports were going to be coming in. So I'm not, you know, that's, it was a lot of information, and I thought surely it would be from someone who was part of the team.
And as she gave you this, for you and your husband, stunning diagnosis, any resources, any ways to think about it, anything other than,
well,
here's the problem?
Well, I don't recall that. I asked her about resources, and she really didn't have an answer other than your special ed department, which Billy wasn't really eligible for till the age of 3. And the resources were limited. I don't think she really knew that much about autism. You know, as I said before, Temple Grandin hadn't even written any, I don't think she'd written any of her books yet. You know, there was just this, the only cultural association that most people had with the word autism was Rain Man, which was this movie that Tom Cruise was in, and Dustin Hoffman plays his autistic brother. And it's a very slanted, stereotypical version of what it means to be on the autism spectrum. So he's a savant, he likes numbers, but who he is as a person, as a human being who has relationships and bonding, is nowhere to be found, really, in that movie.
And it was nowhere to be found in the discussion you had with the nurse that day.
No, and I think that, I think Matt and I felt that and felt immediately the isolation. And that I felt sort of just emotionally that day, never realizing that with this diagnosis, you know, families get isolated very easily.
Yes. What were the first weeks after you received that diagnosis like for you at home? You had one child, Ben, and you had another child, Billy. What mm-hmm. was it like for you and the children and your husband?
Well, one story I'll tell you. You know, I consider myself kind of a tough person on some level. I've got some, you know, I'm pretty strong, and I thought I had this under control, right? You know, so I thought, okay, well, we're going to, you know, the diagnosis was Friday, you know, a week later, I said, okay, we're going to go to the beach, we're going to enjoy the summer, I'm not going to, like, you know, life goes on. And the next morning I wake up and my face is completely swollen and I have this terrible case of something I'd never had called rosacea before. And it's, you know, I look like a monster. And I realize in that, you know, I realize, wow, you're just not going to be able to just, you know, business as usual. You really have to process this for yourself, for my son Ben, who was quite verbal, and for my relatives. So it became, everyone had to see, they all thought that Billy was this kid who was going to be what they expected, you know, whatever that means, but that his life was going to be, you know, go along, and he would be talking and he would be learning and he would be playing and he would have joy and, you know, sort of all the things that we think little kids are going to have. And to a point that was true. And then all of a sudden we get a diagnosis and it's just like this precipice. And I wanted to, so all of a sudden we re-examining, well, who is Billy? Did I not understand who Billy was?
Yeah.
And so, you know, for my parents, for example, the grandparents, you know, there were, and for all of us, there was like a period of grieving, because what we thought was going to happen, who we thought Billy was, is not the case. And so at some point I remember saying to my mother, I said, you know, Billy is not dead. He is here with us. He's jumping, dancing, thriving. He has challenges ahead, but Billy is with us. And so we sort of rebooted, if you will, and tried to, you know, affirm Billy, affirm ourselves, affirm our lives.
What was it like for his brother?
Well, you know, Ben is 3.5 years older, and I remember Ben was always asking questions. And so, to give you an example, there was this time period, you know, and I'm not sh- you know, everything, Billy, nothing was intuitive for Billy. If you talk to people who have, you know, significant, Billy's got basically classic autism. He has many of, you know, the what you would consider many of the, you know, facets of it. He also has great strengths. I mean, and I can talk about those, and I'd like to talk about that later. But with Ben, you know, Billy, for a while, for a couple years when he was very young, Billy used to run around the kitchen table and at dinner every night, and was, and I think he was getting something out of the what the spinning, the circles, and he really didn't, for some reason, wasn't interested in sitting for dinner. So I, you know, thought that it was very important that Billy learn to eat dinner with his brother and sit there and to have this social experience. So every day, you know, Ben would say, why is he running around in circles? And I just, you know, I would say, well, I'm not sure why he's doing that. And so I tried to be as candid with Ben as possible. At the same time, one of the things they shared was music and dance. And really, it was a lifeline for them. And so that every night after dinner, they would go down to the basement. Ben would put on whatever music was, you know, and Billy would run and spin, and Ben would dance and cavort. And they had this communication. They had this relationship, which, you know, we were fortunate that that was a bond for them.
The idea that there can be communications, and which is much of what you talk about in Learning to Kiss, the idea that there can be communications and it can be nonverbal is something that I think a lot of times we don't pay attention to, although so much of how human beings communicate is nonverbal.
Exactly. Communication is a conglomerate, you know. True communication is about the visual, the reading of, as I said before, you know, the eye contact, hearing the voice, giving the social feedback, observing the intonations, the body gestures. I mean, all of that goes into the essence of what communication is. Now, at this point, Billy is using a communication device, which is a Panasonic computer, and it has voice output. We didn't start there, mind you, but when he's speaking, one of the reasons, the way that we programmed it is pretty unique in that both his scripts, what he wants to say, the questions he wants to ask, the comments, the negotiation, whatever it is on that device. And it by the way, it's ongoing dynamic because Billy changes and his communication needs change. And it's very specific, it's not generic. But it's also the communication partner script, so that Billy understands and the communication partner understands on some level that the act of communication is a social interaction and that it requires pauses and it requires silence sometimes. And that's a piece that actually I learned from Billy. I didn't really understand that the same way. And go ahead.
Well, I want to back up a bit.
Yeah.
Let's go back to by the time Billy was three and he was eligible for services, mm-hmm. How had his behavior changed and what were the services that he was actually eligible for at three?
Well, Billy, a couple things I'd say about that. He was eligible because he had the diagnosis of pervasive developmental disorder, which became autism, an autism diagnosis. And that he was eligible to receive early, what they called early intervention services. And that, and in his case, because, you know, his system, his neurological system, his sensory system, his communication style was all under tremendous duress now. And just to kind of give you an example of that, he, at that, right about the time that he was going to go to this program that was in our town, the special ed department said you can, at that point there was no services in town, so they said, well, you can look at any program you want and we'll determine whether that's an appropriate fit. So so Billy, as he got older, like from year and a half to three, his symptoms became worse. And that's often what you see, is that his communication breakdowns were more frequent. His sensory system was, his needs to whatever, to whether it was pressure he needed, whether the things bothered him. You know, he didn't like his nails getting cut. He didn't like his hair being cut. All these things were, you know, kind of in now coming to the forefront. So we had a Billy who we needed help, but let me say that's all true. And then with that, I would say that our first meeting with the special education department, the head of it, was in our town when we had our first meeting about Billy. You know, she thinking out in my mind, I was like, well, what about Billy? I haven't heard anybody say anything specifically about Billy. And then when this conversation was about over, she summarizes her remarks by saying the following: what Billy needs to learn is how to comply. And I, knowing nothing about special ed and barely knowing anything about autism, I looked at her and shot back and said, no, what Billy needs to learn is how to communicate. And that sort of set the stage for my philosophical difference with many educators about what the kind of education and the expectations we should have about an individual like Billy, whether it's nonverbal, low verbal, with autism, in terms of communication. I think that they sought out someone, their goals were that Billy become a compliant communicator. That is, that he listen and receive information from adults and do basically comply with all the directives. That would have been their definition of success. That was not my definition of success for Billy. I wanted Billy to be able to be an expressive communicator. I wanted him to be an independent communicator. I wanted him to ask his questions. I wanted him to be able to get answers. I wanted him to express his emotions. I wanted him to, you know, have a point of view, be able to object to something. I wanted Billy to be Billy. And I was, frankly, it was a journey in terms of the challenges that this different mindset about who Billy was and what I thought Billy, who Billy is, a compliant communicator or an expressive communicator.
You wanted Billy
both
to have a life.
I did. I wanted him to acknowledge that he is a communicator. I mean, one of the things that happened even in 2017 is that when people use the word nonverbal, either socially, casually, or even in the diagnosis or what have you, that's a code, really. That's code for that they're somehow substantially separate from us, that they have nothing to contribute, that and what it means in reality is that, you know, no one acknowledges that these children, these individuals have a point of view, that they are curious, that they want choices, that they think about, care about, and love others, that they experience humor. I mean, remorse. I cannot, you know, tell you how we're really in the dark ages in terms of the way individuals with autism, particularly who are nonverbal or low verbal, are educated. They really do not have access to alternative and augmentative communication supports, and they do not have an ongoing communication-based education. So what happens to these folks? Probably around the age of 10 or 11, you'll get educators who will say things to the point where they'll say, this child is having problems, and that's their autism. And so we no longer can deal with their problems and their autism, and so we want them to go to someplace else. And so you'll see a lot of kids like the Billies of the world, because they've never been taught the elements involved in a communication exchange. They haven't been taught how to utilize communication supports, whether they are low-tech or high-tech. And, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy on some level. So in my mind, you know, if I'm advocating for anything, I'm advocating that we start looking, that when we say the nonverbal, we say nonverbal communicator, because that's who they are.
So, I mean, they're communicating, it's just not with words.
Communicating all the time, yes.
When we talk about autism, and we say it's a spectrum, can you give folks a sense of the range of experiences or behaviors that may show up with a person who has autism?
Well, I'm going to say two things, two tenets that I believe in, so you'll see how I will speak about that. I believe that all behaviors are communication acts. They may not be the best communication acts. They might not be as appropriate. They may be have to have further education, but they are all communication. And I believe that all individuals on the autism spectrum are communicators. So with that said, there is a spectrum, if you will, of, you know, descriptions about, depictions about what autism means. Now, what you have to understand that it's not a medical diagnosis. This is when someone gets the diagnosis of autism, they're simply checking out boxes, whether it's social relatedness, it might be sensory issues related to it. So, for instance, they might have what they call tactile defensiveness. They have trouble with nails and haircuts and sometimes, and it might, that might be all of it. They might have more extreme, you know, sort of tactile defense mechanisms. They might not like certain textures in food. They might not, sameness is something that's very important too. But a lot of times when the people want sameness, routines, don't like transitions, it's because they're trying to create order out of chaos because they don't understand what's going on. And they don't, and from an auditory processing point of view, sometimes a lot of these into folks really aren't processing what you are verbally saying to them. There tend, a lot of folks on the spectrum tend to be more visually, their learning is visually based, and so they really need to see the symbol or the picture or the text associated with the word. They have a different way of communicating, and that's part of what's not acknowledged in 2017. So the communication, the social relatedness, the tendency to want sameness, difficulty with transitions, you know, there's a whole sort of cadre of lists. Now, the problem with that is when you start checking off these little boxes, it doesn't say, well, where can you, is that, it's not a death knell, you know, it's sort of, it only means at this point in time. So a lot of these things, with the right education, can improve dramatically. Just to give you, to give you a quick example of Billy. When Billy was in 10 or 11, 12, something like that, he was having what people who don't think of individuals as on the autism spectrum as communicators, they would say he's having an autism behavior. I would say he's having an autism communication breakdown. So let's see what it is. So he's going, it's dinner time, and he's running from one room to the other room, and kitchen to the side room where the driveway is, kitchen to the side room. He jumps, he grinds his teeth, he makes some sounds of disapproval, and I'm thinking, now I could say if I thought like, could say from a behavioral standpoint, oh, this is an autism behavior. We need to replace it, we need to extinguish it, we need to, you know, many things that you can do in that sort of vein of thinking. I look at it as he's communicating something. It finally dawned on me because I was looking at it through that lens that Billy had a question, but he had no way to ask it, and he had no confirmation, clarification, which would have helped, would have reduced his anxiety, and that was, is Dad coming home for dinner? He had the question in his mind, but he had no way of asking it. So we programmed that, you know, he could ask, is Dad coming home for dinner? And I could say yes, I could say no, I could say why, all these different reasons why. And as soon as he got was treated like a communicator. As soon as we had that social engagement, there was no jumping. There was no grinding of teeth.
That is extraordinary.
Right.
That's truly extraordinary, and is a wonderful illustration of the value of the perspective that you talk about as a communications breakdown versus just a behavioral problem, essentially.
Correct, yes. I had a person when I was recently, I was in Chicago presenting, and I was saying that all we have to start thinking of all behaviors as communication. And so this mother who has a child, and an adult child, raised her hand, and she said to me, "My son spits at people. What do you think about that?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know the circumstances, but does your son have a way to communicate? Does he have a low-tech support? Does he have, you know, how do they communicate with your son?" He said, "Well, they have a device, or, you know, some kind of communication device, but they say they don't want to use it because they're afraid it will get broken, so it stays up on the shelf." And I said, "Well, I don't really know why the circumstances, but if I was your son, I'd spit too, because I would be angry." You know, and then she went on to say, "Well, he actually is. It's very focused to very specific people."
Interesting.
And I thought, well, that's interesting, because clearly maybe there's communication breakdowns that are, you know, in that interaction.
When you say that's interesting, that it's just specific people, so he clearly is communicating something. When you say low-tech or high-tech devices, give us an example of both. What's a low-tech and what's a high-tech device?
Well, a low-tech would be, for example, Billy does yoga, okay, and we get pictures from Google or, you know, wherever, we magazines or wherever, but we create these visual systems so that Billy's going to know exactly what the sequence of moves will be in yoga, okay? So that's low-tech. That's just, you know, visual support. It could be schedules. It could be, you know, the one thing that folks on the autism spectrum really want to know is, what am I doing? How long am I doing it for? And then what's next? Like most human beings in the world, right? And interesting, a lot of times we are at our, us who are verbal are at our worst when we're communicating with people who are nonverbal. We actually don't communicate with them very well if we communicate. And I've got a story about that one. But the low tech would be anything from visual schedules to schedules that about like what you're going to do in a specific, what we call sub schedules, like in a specific activity. So it's very much, I stress independence a lot, because I see too many people, not just in the odd world of autism, but just in general with special needs, et cetera, who are so dependent on the adult, whoever, point person, for everything. And I want to walk in a room and I want to see Billy and his peers referencing a schedule, referencing directions, referencing whatever it is, rather than waiting for the teacher to tell them what to do.
I see.
And then the high tech is simply going to be, it could be any, and depending, it could be an iPad. We've come a long, long way. Billy and I are kind of pioneers in the world of high tech communication, in the sense that, you know, we were on it just as the technology was advancing. Every time it went somewhere else, we went there with it. But now you've got the iPad, you've got phones, you've smartphones, you've got computers that you can put certain types of text on, et cetera.
So it really does run the range in terms of opportunities to communicate.
Yeah, there's more, you know, here's the problem, though. There are more opportunities to communicate. It doesn't mean that individuals on the autism spectrum are getting a communication-based education or that they're being treated like communicators. So that's, you know, you can have a lot of times this technology is being utilized to, as we see it in other contexts, to give somebody something to do. So play certain for leisure activities, doing it for sort of more in that category rather than the area of true communication.
You've been talking about some of the things that are missing in terms of awareness, and you talked about I don't recall how old Billy was, but he had chicken pox, and you talked about the experience where you took him to the doctor's office, and the doctor didn't understand that Billy didn't understand, and how frustrating that must have been for you and Billy.
Yes, that Billy had a very severe case of chicken pox, which, and because he's nonverbal and he can't tell me, and not just nonverbal, a lot of folks on the autism, when they are distressed, have difficulty communicating the source of their distress. And so when I tried to tell the doctor, which I thought was clear communication, it was almost as if saying that someone is nonverbal, the recipient of that message just doesn't know what that means or how to translate it. So they just continue on as if this person is verbal. And so it's been an interesting a lot of people want to speak to Billy verbally. But I always say, well, you have to use his language system. His language system is voice output, but it's also visual, because he has this communication device, and he's very, by the way, no one thought he would ever be able to navigate it, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But people frequently ask me, will he go up to just someone and start communicating with this device? And my answer to that is, well, probably not, because he assumes that they don't know his language system. It would be like me going up to someone who speaks Chinese and trying to communicate with them.
Okay.
And so, you know, it is interesting. You know, one of the other thing about the medical experience I want to bring up too is that a lot of times individuals on the autism expression, their expressions of pain are not orthodox. They're unorthodox in the sense that somebody might say, for example, when Billy was at the throes of pain, and by the way, for 5 years he was basically, bedridden. He started just, he'd never hit himself at all, ever. And that was an expression of pain. It was almost like he was punishing himself for these experiences he was having. So what happens is that when a person has these, whatever the behaviors are, they start doing pinching themselves, or they might, the gamut. People don't interpret, first of all, they don't view them as communicators, and they do not interpret their behaviors as communication, which gets these kids going down a rabbit hole into other treatments, behavior plans, psychopharmacology, when in fact they may have, which is often the case, medical issues, gastrointestinal issues, esophagus issues, which are often part of the autism diagnosis.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to find out more about how all of this is impacting you as the mom, because you're working so hard to advocate for your son. Folks, we will return in just a moment and continue the conversation with Eve McGargle, who is author of Learning to Kiss. Don't go away. as you talk about the experiences of your son, the intensity and the passion with which you understand your son and advocate for your son is so clear. And I have to ask, what is this like for you on the inside? You're his mom. This is not what you wanted for him. Clearly, you are working so hard to provide him with the best quality of life possible. How do you manage?
Well, that started back 27 years ago, frankly. The shock of the diagnosis, and then basically realizing very early on, as we talked about, that I viewed Billy as a communicator, and so everything that the curriculum, his education, all of it, was communication. So it became kind of in effect, a part full-time job. And I would say, I enjoy Billy in the moment. There's a lot of joy. He has a great sense of humor. So much, I have so much to be grateful for. He's been through a lot. And, of course, I've been through a lot as a result of that. But at the end of the day, we have learned from each other so many things. And I have so much faith in Billy. And I think that, I've been supported by, I have a good relationship with my husband. My son now, Ben, is an adult who's very supportive. I think we're a better family because we know how valuable communication is. And I don't know if I'm answering that question very well, but I would say, too, that there's a lot of, I'm not only advocating for Billy, because, frankly, Billy is in a new place now. His health has improved tremendously. We seem to be at another level. His communication is fluent. I'm advocating for all those folks I see out there, the little kids I see, and I don't see any type of communication, education going on. And I worry about them when they're going to be 12, 15, because I do worry about this, somehow that they're going to be so misunderstood. They're not going to be able to communicate. I see this now, even with young adults who come over to our program. They don't understand the meaning of a choice because they've never been given choices.
Interesting.
They don't, it's so I'm so so passionate and so interested and, sort of intellectually stimulated by all of this that I see it as not just for Billy, but as a calling that's more broad-based than that.
Let me ask you a question about Billy's artwork. Is this his artwork on the cover of your book?
Yes, it is. It's a painting he did about 2 years ago. It's a 48x48. And I looked at it one day and decided that should be on the cover.
It's beautiful.
No, thank you.
It is. I love the colors. Talk about Billy's artwork.
Yeah, the story behind that, you got to remember, the Billies of the world don't get art classes. I mean, a lot of people don't get art classes, but they really don't get art classes. They don't get a lot of anything like that, music, the arts, which is what Billy's involved in now, ironically. So I decided that one summer he was in a 12-month program, and I said, well, we're going to try, experimenting with colors and make it a literacy program but also art, and show him the different spectrum of colors that he can identify and color in the word, from it says red and you do the red and so forth. And I didn't think much about it other than that I just wanted to expose him to this. And then as an adolescent, Billy becomes very ill. And, he had started painting in the summer a little bit as he had gotten a little older. And, we were at the beginning stages, and I went and I would go to all these kitchen stores and pharmacies and, you know, auto stores, whatever I could think of, and looking for anything where he could dip it in paint and he could create texture. So I was sort of thinking like, in my mind, it was sort of Billy's kind of a physical guy. He's athletic, you know, sort of a Jackson Pollock athletic way, getting a lot of feedback from what he was doing. So I thought of it as educational. So when Billy was very ill, the only thing on his schedule maybe that he would do is he'd be in his room for all day, and maybe one time he'd go down to the basement and he would put color on a canvas. And every night I'd come home with groceries and I'd see these colors and I'd see the movement, and I'd think, there's something about this that's just so, you know, I don't know, just inspirational for some reason. And the fact that he was really, through his art, expressing himself. He didn't feel like the neon pinks and the punch lime greens and the, you know, the bright iridescent colors, but he had that in his spirit. And so I always remembered that this time, it was just this, like this, you know, I come from a family that went to church 3 times a week, and, you know, we used to, this little light of mine was a song that I used to sing, and it was like this light in the basement for me. And so through that, Billy, we just kept going. I kept observing. I created a certain way for him to look at his art and how to do it. And so he basically, but what Billy's gift to this is that his ability to look and create different, put different colors together is really unbelievable. He's so gifted in that area because it's very visual. And so now I show him sculpture, I show him all kinds of things to be inspired by. And the work that he puts out, we put it out on Instagram, we put it out on his web, you know, with his website, WMM Art Gallery. His inspirations are beautiful. And he gets so much from looking at other types of artwork.
The artwork that he has produced, some of it is in permanent installations, yes?
Yeah, he's got quite a few big pieces at Mass General Hospital, some office buildings. Yeah, he's becoming publicly recognized, actually. And so it's you know, we started from a little seed of faith, and we just kept working in the moment, kind of. And the other thing is, I would say, is I'm constantly, well, what's the net, you know, the challenge, not to keep things the same, but to grow, develop, like we all want to do. And so his work is a testimony to how we are all lifelong learners.
We have been talking in the main about the challenges that Billy had, and now we've sort of moved over to the strengths and the talents that Billy has. In addition to his artwork and his increasing, it sounds like, communication skills, is there more that you would like to share about Billy?
I think Billy really, let me give you a quick example. I think examples often say so much more. I think Billy really understands the meaning of rest, relaxation, meditation. No one would have ever said that someone on the autism spectrum, particularly someone who's nonverbal, would ever know what that means. But Billy, to get this example, last summer, had to go in for endoscopy. And they wanted to do this test. And it was a test, you put these little pellets in the lining of the esophagus, and this actual box that is on a belt you wear, and they can do acid rate readings. And so I thought, oh my God, you know, Billy is never going to wear a belt. He never wears belts. He's not going to want this device on him for 24 hours. This is going to be a disaster. Now, that's going in my mind, and then I'm saying, you know, to people, I say, okay, well, let's write the social story. Let's explain to him why he's using this, what's going on. And, you know, I was holding my breath. And when Billy looked at it, read the social story. We talked about it through his device, and he was okay with it. And so he then went to the hospital, and we're in the room, and I'm getting to the meditation, relaxation. Oh, there's all these fluorescent lights, and there's these things beeping, and there's these nurses coming back and forth, and everybody's a little, always a little more hyper when they know somebody with autism who's nonverbal and 27 is showing up. And, you know, Billy's fine. He's sitting there, and he's taking it all in. And I look over at him, and he takes this deep breath, and he just sort of closes his eyes, and he just rests. He knows exactly what's going to happen. He knows he's going to have an endoscopy, but he knows what he needs. And I think that, you know, teaching, thinking about children and teaching them how to relax, not just telling them to relax, so things like that are so important in terms of their adult life because they don't stay little kids.
Well, they're so important for everyone.
Exactly. Everything I say, I think, applies to all of us,
right?
That we all need to expand our way, our understanding and application of how we communicate with individuals. You know, we all need to learn more elements in terms of how do we relax, how we reduce anxiety. All of this is, you know, paramount to all human beings.
Billy is now 27. Where is he living?
He lives with us. We have the program, we have a couple barns that the Voice Colors program is in. And because Billy is stable, he does take medications for his medical issues. And right now, this wellness and arts program was developed as a result of Billy being ill and the fact that I didn't see out in the adult world any place for Billy.
And does that mean that Billy will be living with you until he's not?
Well, that's an interesting. I'm now at another juncture in terms of thinking. You know, I thought, in hindsight, I thought that for a while, I thought that, you know, the early years were the toughest years. But I don't really think that anymore. I think that perhaps where we are now, because we're sort of getting to a fork in the road, and that he is an adult, and we are not here forever. And how do we manage that? How do we create a situation for Billy that is remains, you know, meaningful, enriched, and he has relationships in his life, and that he understands that we're part of his life, but we're not there in the same way? And that, I think, is a challenge for probably every parent.
Absolutely. I don't hear you talking about Billy socializing in the way that we would typically think. Movies, skating, going to a library, any of those things.
Oh, yeah. He goes, well, that's not really true. He goes out every Saturday. His diet's very restrictive. It's, you know, gluten, dairy, egg free. So he used to go to restaurants, but that's not really an option. So he and his dad go out to all kinds of stores, bookstores, sporting goods stores, comic stores, you name it, they go to it. Billy, for years and years, was in an ice skating. He was in a swimming, he's been in swimming programs. So he's had a lot of social components to his life. But when he got very ill, you know, everything kind of diminished, and now we're now trying to expand his horizons.
For those listening to our conversation today who perhaps are in the beginnings of dealing with someone, a loved one with who's on the spectrum, what do you want them to think about?
Well, there's a lot of things to think about, but first of all, enjoy your child. Develop your relationship. Cultivate your communication with your child. And get to know them. But beyond that, I would say that you remember you're the historian. You know you're going to be the advocate for your child. You are the international representative to all these different people and groups that are going to come into your life, but also your child's life. And so you need to be the historian and provide perspective. And I would say that one, remember always that all individuals are communicators who are on the autism spectrum. They have a right to have access to communication supports and to a communication-based education, and you really should look for that. You should look for really a, no one sort of system is right. Most people need different pieces from an educational puzzle to provide the best services. So, you know, really advocate for making sure that communication is part of that and it's dynamic, and that that people and his their life, you know, don't settle, don't assume that it has to be the lowest level just because they're telling you that. Ask your own questions. Come to your own conclusions.
In the afterword of your book, there's a commentary that's offered by Dr. Christopher McDougall, who is the director of the Lurie Center for Autism at Mass General Hospital. And I just want to share a couple of words from him. He says, a wake-up call is in order for half a million children with autism who will become adults in the next decade. Society at large has not grasped the fact that autism is a lifelong disorder. Measures will not suffice until real changes are put in place. I imagine you agree with that.
Absolutely. And at the hospital that Billy spent so much time at Mass General, based upon his experiences, our experiences, and the fact that most individuals who are adults now are not being treated by adult practitioners but by pediatrics. Billy's, all of his services are in pediatrics. We, Matt and I, advocated for a, created a document that said that it's time to, the whole SIDS hospital needs to become educated about what autism is, that they deserve to have their medical issues treated just like any other human being. And so I'm really excited about what's going on in terms of, there's a sort of, one of the things that happened as a result of all of our experiences is a autism care questionnaire that's available through Mass General Lurie Center. And parents who are interested in looking at it, it really provides, it provides a questionnaire about communication, about hospital visits, like what your child will need, how they should, how things should be presented, about your, you know, safety issues with your child, comfort issues, how, strategies for reducing anxiety. All of this is in a questionnaire that you as the parent or the caregiver, legal guardian can fill out and make sure that this is part of your child's profile when they are going to a doctor or a dentist, or in their future they will be going to some sort of medical appointment.
That is absolutely wonderful. Eve McGargle, author of Learning to Kiss. Thank you so much, Eve, for joining us today, and thank you for the work that you're doing on behalf of those on the autism spectrum.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You're encouraged to be in touch with me by sending an email to Pamela@mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. Mind Talk is available on demand by going to mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or from the Google Play Store. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.